Thank you, Richard. Okay, so our final speaker is Justin Ho, who's going to speak on the perilous journey to natural perils pricing. I think someone's already spoken about what a perilous country Australia is. Property insurance premiums make up about a third of all of our insurance premiums, and about a third of that is collected to pay expenses, and about a third for attritional losses, and about a third for weather-related losses. So pricing natural perils and understanding natural perils insurance is obviously very important to all property insurers. Now, Justin is currently the manager for natural perils pricing at IAG. He enjoys the challenge of meeting the needs of the organisation and getting a more granular view of risk, particularly in perils risk, through the combination of traditional and non-traditional actuarial skill sets, technologies and data. Thanks, Justin.
Hopefully the title comes very apparent why it is a perilous journey. There's a lot of consideration. So these again are my thoughts, so don't shoot me down. Welcome to listen on different conversations and discussion points. Well, the first bit is like with perils pricing, it's obviously know your perils. What perils should we consider? So, you know, I've listed down, you know, just a list of the perils that you might want to consider, you know, flood, bushfire, cyclone, hail, tsunami, meteor showers. What should we be concerned about? Well, the thing is, it really depends. What's your focus? So it depends on the region you're analysing or the line of business you're looking at, or even like the part of your reinsurance program, the layer. So, for example, obviously in New South Wales, for domestic property risk, what drives the top end of your reinsurance cover would be accumulation risk. So it would be like an earthquake type of event or a severe hail, potentially a flood. More at the lower ends, it's more about your working losses. So, you know, typical type of storm events. In Victoria, you know, there's quite a lot of obviously bushfire risk that has to be considered. What about in Southeast Asia? Well, you know, it depends again on the region. So you've got earthquake risk in, say, certain parts of Indonesia, tsunami risk, you could say. And also there's significant flood or inundation risk. How about commercial insurance? Well, there's the business interruption component that we have to consider. I've also attached just a quick list of the top 10 disasters in Australia from the ICA disaster database, revalued to, I guess, recent terms. Is that any surprising to you that Sydney Hailstorm, the 1999, was close to 4.3 revalued? Cyclone Tracy, this. Okay. So those are just things to consider about. This next slide is more about, well, in order to be successful in perils pricing, it's actually kind of a jack of all trades to some respect, but you never have enough experience in one particular area. So it's the ability to collaborate against with a whole lot of smart people, basically. So I'll just list down some of the skill sets or some of the teams or people that you will collaborate with, and it's very important. So not only you need the natural hazard expertise, whether it's in-house or external, whether it's the meteorological component, hydrological, seismology, scientific type or engineering viewpoint. Obviously, reinsurance, you know, you've got your brokers, you've got your reinsurers, you've got the vendor models, the catastrophe modelling. So that's a very key plank in order to get a view of risk, but it's not everything. You've got your statistical and actual know-how. You need that in this line of business. And increasingly, there's a greater sophistication for other techniques and other skill sets. Geospatial expertise, I think, is absolutely critical to be successful in really analysing your risk. There's a lot of kind of like granularisation of risk, and that needs to be visualised and also analysed. And then you have to collaborate your product and underwriting areas, sales and marketing, distribution channels, systems. Yeah, so those type of last 3 points, it doesn't, just because you're looking at perils, it's no different to non-peril perspective. All right, the next is what I call the merry-go-round. And if you look at the little cartoon, I'm not sure if it shows up clearly, you know, it's going around too fast. And like, slow down a little bit, slow down. Because it's kind of like that. In a high-level point of view, there's like the technical viewpoint, the technical modelling, iterative process, right? You do have the vendor models, but equally you have your own internal models, your own internal view, right? And so iterative process, refining that. Whether you get external or internal expertise on the hazard modelling component, you're trying to get a best view on risk, try to anyway. Then the next component is about the commercialization process. It doesn't really differ, again, the perils, non-perils, it's same. It's very similar issues, but there are key differences. So I'll just quickly list a few. You know, well, obviously you need to look at your profitability. You know, how are you going to compare? For that peril, do you want to write at a loss? Do you want to write at a smaller margin? The competitive environment, your retention strategy, right? What about the cross-product effects, right? The customer. Customer is key, as we always hear. And one of the main differences, I think, in terms of when you compare non-perils and perils, apart from, let's say, for liability at a point in time, it's a reputational and affordability component. And I'll talk a bit more about that later down the track. And then there's also like business type of other business decisions that you have to consider, the distributor channel relationships. What about product design? Finally, it's once you've got those commercial viewpoints, it's the actual implementation, the doing. Are there any constraints with your how you go out to market? So it's the rating engine, right? And that, in the end, produces the commercialized frame. Right. So I'll just kind of go through some of the, inputs into the process. The data side, so feeding the model. Right? How sure are we with regard to the quality and quantity of your data inputs? So not only you look at your exposures and the signature, the asset details, risk location, year of construction, construction type, occupancy types, roof type, dwelling type, all that impacts on the vulnerability, you could say. You know? But what about the quality of it? Are there missing values or defaults? Those are the things, common sense, but you know, things that you definitely need to consider. The policy details, so obviously excess deductibles limits, all that needs to be allowed for. And then a big bucket is called these external factors. Hazard information, right? Your topography, terrain, meteorological, seismicity, vegetation data. How granular is that? And the last story is, well, great, we have this information. In terms of perils pricing or perils view on risk, you could say you never have enough data because we're pricing on events like 1 in 200, but equally, you know, for flooding events, we're looking at PMFs, since they're 1 in 10,000. You know, what the heck? You know, it's such long periods of time. So you just have to make do with what you got, whether it's industry data, your own internal data, judgment call. All right. A key aspect with regards to the data is the building attributes. How certain are we with regards to the building location? And for certain perils, it's absolutely key. This is an example of a... So the little dots represent the national address database with regards to the location of a property or what, you know, from the GNAF, or I guess that's what they call it. But is it really? Is it really that little dot latitude, longitude is the true location of your property. And you can see some examples here where, here's one example there, that little red dot, that's the national database. But if you do an aerial imagery, well, it's actually a few meters away. And the end story is, for flood and for, in some extent, bushfire, it's absolutely critical. You know, a movement of 5 to 10 meters can mean the difference between tens of thousands of dollars with regards to flood prones. Bushfire is very similar with regards to the distance of the property to the nearest high-risk vegetation, you could say. Here's another example, your elevation data. The key aspect of all of this is garbage in, garbage out. You know, how granular is your elevation data? If you're using it for inundation risk, and you've got a very coarse type of elevation, such as the STRM, which is basically 90 meter grids, right, and with a certain vertical accuracy, I can't remember exactly how inaccurate, but anyway, as compared to the LIDAR type view, LIDAR is more the laser type of metric that you get from planes flying over a landscape, as opposed to the SRTM, which is from a shuttle kind of beam down something. But the key aspect is it can be absolutely critical for certain aspects of your hazard assessment. And then, you know, the model told me so. Well, just because an output from a model, should we really agree with it? And my answer is that, you know, quite common sense is like, take it with a grain of salt, doesn't make sense. Should we use it? Be aware of the deficiencies in the model. Or if you're not really sure, find out. Yeah, so for example, you do have vendor models for, say, you know, for earthquake, hail, cyclone, right? Equally for flood risk, you know, there is a national database, the NFID, but is that good enough? Yeah. The little table here is just a kind of graphic of the different vulnerability assumptions based on different type of studies. So what assumption should you use? Kind of all over the place, you know? One vulnerability assessment. So basically it's just saying that for each flood depth, you know, what's the percentage of damage as a percentage of the sum assured? So which one should you use? And that's one of the headaches that my team and my fellow colleagues have to deal with. What is appropriate, right? So yes, you've got industry data, but equally you could make use of your internal data to validate whether that's right or wrong. Right? Yeah. With perils model, there's one aspect where, are there any perils that haven't been really modelled to any real great extent? And I'm kind of thinking like the storm component. That's a massive bucket of where, in terms of the analysis or development with regards to the models of that, there's a lot of question marks over it. So how should we approach that? So I won't answer it, but I'm just pondering those questions out to the audience. Think about it. Okay, another example, earthquake. This is an example of the previous earthquakes in Christchurch on the left-hand side. There's Christchurch there. The little dots represent individual earthquake events of different sizes. So that first left-hand side is basically all the earthquake events between 1800s to 2010. So you can see quite a bit of smattering of earthquakes around. But look what happened after the September 2010 event to 2011. Yeah, so it's the case that, well, okay, our historical experience says, you know, this is our view on risk. You know, now we've got a lot more new data points. Whoopee, yeah, we've got more data points. That's excellent. But it just means that, you know, just again, perils, never enough data. Make do with what you got. New data point, excellent. Now we've got information. All right, so this is a slide just kind of outlining some of the issues. We all have issues with regards to pricing for perils. So the key, one of the key take-outs that I want to kind of impart on the audience is that with a lot of the sophistication with modelling, we're getting very granular with a view on risk. So you'd say like 10, 15 years ago, you know, you never would even contemplate pricing at an individual address level basis. Now we're at that stage. We've got that flood, we've got that bushfire. What about the other perils? Well, probably you can get more granular, maybe not necessarily to the house, but at least it's getting more granular. So there's a lot more movement away from community risk rating to risk differentiation. Right? And with that comes a very surprising result. You get affordability issues. You get pockets where it's just like, yeah, can we actually put a price out to market for that risk? So that leads to consideration with regards to going out to market. You know, how should we deal with these large pricing changes? Right? Whether you have a capping system, floor to your premiums, or with your renewables, are you going to have a percentage of change or a dollar, change type of capping regime? Right? What about the referral process? What are you going to do with those customers that are upset with their premiums? Are you going to kind of say, well, the price is what it is, or are you going to listen to their call and adjust your pricing because they have more information than what you might have assumed? Another consideration is reinsurance costs. Do we say, let's take the short-term view of reinsurance, or let's take the long-term view? These are some of the considerations when we set out to market the pricing. And then with all this, we kind of looked at it in the lens of like, oh, this is the cost of the risk, right? But then equally, there is a demand side. Yeah, so it's a difference, it's very two different type of ways to consider the pricing. And I did mention about asset location changes, whether you allow for that information in terms of your pricing. And on flood, obviously, whether you have optional to demandary type of cover. What's been interesting that I've noticed is that there's different ways of dealing with uncertainty. So the normal way from an actuarial perspective is the greater the uncertainty, you put a loading on it. But what I found is when you talk to the business people, they say, well, your models are uncertain. Why should you put on a price of a certain amount? If you're uncertain, then we're not happy with that. So there's another notion that, well, if you're uncertain, let's actually put a discount to your view. That's one point of view. Maybe not the right point of view, but it's a point of view. And you talk to different business people that have different ways of thinking. And so what I'll really kind of highlight that, the commercialized pricing can be very different to the technical view on risk. So this slide is just a few headlines of the reputational risk. So with that granularization of risk comes issues with affordability. Massive issue. You can't just ignore it. So that is a key factor in terms of how we decide the pricing. Right, and lastly, it's more to do with like the implementation, the rating engine, your rating algorithm. How sophisticated is it? Does it price out the area of view? Address level pricing, is it suburb? How about does your perils do they add up? Do you price specifically for that peril, and then everything else is kind of in a big mixing basket? You don't really know how much you allow for it. Not really sure. Yeah, that's my fear about the industry. There is that type of, there is not a, not really sure. We know something in there, but, close our eyes. Hopefully it will do us fine. And how does this, perils pricing interact with, your discount structures or with the other coverages? So I like to come from the point of view of greater transparency. That's just my philosophy, but it's a bit of a battle. Right. And then there's issues with like multiplicative structure versus the additive structure. So it doesn't make sense. If you have like a, say, for bushfire, you have relativity, and you apply that relativity to your base prim, you know, does that make sense? Right? Because your base prim is, you know, could be dictated by or changes through other non-peril related things. So the end result is you get a prim that may not necessarily be what you intended. Okay. Lastly, communication. Communication with all of this is absolutely key, both in an internal point of view and external stakeholders. Yeah. So I think I've ran out of time, but I'll have one very quick example for flood again, my favourite topic. So we've got an example of this aerial imagery, and basically the story goes, we have this is a real life story. Customer comes up, complains that, hang on, why is my prim so expensive? This is not right. Right? We have information from the local council, a proper public flood study that says that it is a high risk. So the actual house itself is located here. Right? Right, so you might think, oh, great, you know, this is, you know, public information, it's got to be right. Right? Now, from the point of view of the business, how would you communicate to that customer? Would you say, you know, council already mentioned that you're high flood risk area. Fine, go away. Here's a view of the elevation data. So it's just basically the, luckily enough, in this particular occasion, we had LiDAR information before and after two different periods. So this is kind of taken just when the public flood study was, I guess, produced. And it was basically, it's in a low-lying area. Ta-da! What's happened? In this particular example, the developer of the housing estate, well, they developed the housing after the public flood study was produced. And what the developer has done, they've kind of infilled land. They raised the elevation of the land. Right? That information is not necessarily available to the customer. May not necessarily, well, you think it's available to the council, but for some reason, the customer didn't have access to this information. Luckily enough, for the insurer, for IAG, at this point in time, we had that information. So we could accurately assess that. Based on the new elevation information, you are low flood risk. And that's the end of my talk.